5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Syria's peace talks put on hold. The United Nations has suspended the current diplomatic effort to chart a course to end the 5-year Syrian conflict after efforts to bring the opposition and government together in proximity talks in Geneva lasted less than a week. UN envoy Stefan de Mistura called the delay until February 25 a temporary pause, not a failure.
The UN cannot allow simply procedural matters to actually become more important than actually the result for the humanitarian situation of the Syrian people who have been waiting for us to deliver, this time not a conference, but something concrete for them. I've therefore taken this decision to bring a temporary pause. Temporary pause. This is not the end and is not the failure of the talks.
Washington blames the pause on Russian airstrikes that disrupted humanitarian aid to Syrians. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
UN Security Council Resolution 2254, for which the Russians voted, calls on the regime and all parties to cease bombings and other attacks on civilians. Not eventually, but immediately.
Kirby said it's difficult in the extreme to see how such strikes against civilian targets contribute in any way to the peace process. Reuters quotes a senior UN official as saying Mr. de Mistura suspended the Geneva talks because Russia's military escalation undermined the negotiating process. Reuters, citing a confidential report to the UN Security Council, says Rwanda is recruiting and training Burundian refugees with the goal of ousting President Pierre Nkurunziza. The report, developed by experts who monitor sanctions on the Democratic Republic of Congo, and spoke with several Burundian combatants. Mr. Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term sparked political unrest. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization Wednesday voiced concern over a case of Zika virus in the U.S. state of Texas caused by sexual transmission. Christian Lindmeyer is a WHO spokesman.
The ways of transmission have to be strongly looked into. Any possible sources of infection for the Zika virus have to be studied carefully. There are many ways which could be a transmission could happen, although right now the vast majority of cases are done by mosquito bites, of course. We do know that the virus stays in the blood for a certain while. We don't even know the exact time.
The WHO declared a global health emergency over the Zika virus Monday. Meanwhile, the governor of the state of Florida has declared a public health emergency in 4 counties in the state with travel-related cases of the virus. In Latin America, where the disease is most widespread, 14 health ministers meeting in Uruguay agreed on a public information campaign and a boost to the number of medical workers to fight the mosquito-borne virus. The U.S. Defense Department acknowledged on Wednesday there are more U.S. troops on the ground in Iraq beyond the approximately 3,500 reported earlier. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the number is actually closer to 3,900, but that has more to do with a rotational schedule than a boost in commitment in the fight against the Islamic State.
So the 82nd Airborne Division has been here for approximately 9 months as the CFLC, the Combined Forces Land Component Command. They're ready to rotate home, go see their families. They're being replaced by the 101st Airborne Division. People can't just leave, have nobody there, and the next day come in, right? That wouldn't make any sense at all. So it's a rotation, and so there's naturally going to be overlap there.
He also announced that Iraq has received a second batch of F-16 warplanes from the U.S. Iraq now has 6. Delivery of 36 ordered by Baghdad has been delayed because of a shortage of Iraqi-trained pilots. Australia's High Court has rejected a challenge to the government's hardline policy on asylum seekers, a decision which clears the way for Canberra to deport more than 200 people. The court Wednesday ruled 6-1 against a Bangladeshi woman who filed a lawsuit challenging Australia's right to deport detained asylum seekers to a refugee camp on the tiny South Pacific island of Nauru. Rights activists have criticized the policy, citing instances of abuse at the camp. An attack on a petroleum pipeline in Nigeria's restive Niger Delta region last week sent crude gushing into creeks and raised fears of a renewed insurgency in the country's oil production heartland. Senator Ben Murray Bruce says the flow of the oil from a ruptured pipeline near Bayelsa State Community of Brass has been stopped. A spokesman for an environmental group said last week's attack marks the 5th time an oil installation in the Delta had been sabotaged since the beginning of the new year. Zambian authorities closed 2 university campuses Wednesday following violent student protests over unpaid meal and book allowances. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 4th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. South Africa's opposition says it's now moved by President Zuma's offer to pay back some of the public funds he used to upgrade his private home.
It's a reflection of the profound political pressure that the president finds himself under at the beginning of 2016. He knows that the pressure on him is absolutely mounting.
Jordan Lewis is an opposition member of parliament. Zimbabwe's constitutional court reaffirmed the banning of the country's criminal defamation law. A conference to alleviate electricity shortages in Africa is underway this week in Washington. And Sierra Leone frees 55 people from recent Ebola quarantine.
They have been in quarantine for the past 21 days and actually completed their incubation period and were released from quarantine yesterday based on the advice from the World Health Organization.
Sidi Yaya Tunis is spokesperson for Public Health Emergency Operations at the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health and will examine the impact of black voters in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Those stories plus Mark Oman's post and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Opposition Democratic Alliance of South Africa says its court case against President Jacob Zuma's use of public money to upgrade his private house will proceed next week as originally planned, despite the president's offer to pay back some of the money. The country's public prosecutor ruled in 2014 that Mr. Zuma personally benefited from the security upgrade of his house, which cost the public $23 million. In a letter, Zuma proposed to refund some of the public funds used for the security upgrade of his private home. Parliamentarian Jordan Lewis tells reporter Peter Clotty that the Democratic Alliance and the people of South Africa, who had demanded accountability all along, have been vindicated.
It's a reflection of the profound political pressure that the president finds himself under at the beginning of 2016. He knows that the pressure on him is absolutely mounting and that he has got to do something to reposition himself more positively with the voters. And so after 5 years of trying to avoid any accountability for the huge multi-million rand upgrades to his house, he has finally admitted some accountability and offered to pay back some of that money. Now, he has left his party in a very embarrassing position because they have been defending him for years and have been holding the line. They are now left with egg on their face.
I understand the Democratic Alliance still want to move ahead to seek more legal redress about this issue of his house upgrade. What is the significance of that and why move ahead if he has admitted, bowed, in fact, to public pressure to pay some of the amount of money that South Africans are calling on him to pay?
Well, because there's an important legal principle at stake here. 3 years ago now, there was an official investigation by the public protector into the president's accountability for it. And the public protector found that he did unduly benefit and that he should be made to pay back some of the money. And he has, for the last several years, found every possible argument to avoid that ruling and to avoid paying back the money. And even now, in his settlement offer, still he will not use the determination made by the public protector. His offer is that the Auditor General should determine how much he must pay back. We are not happy with that. The public protector's ruling must stand, and we are going to court to enforce that ruling and to ensure that the president does undertakes the remedial action that the public protector recommended in her report 3 years ago.
Some people in his party are calling for an independent body to investigate and to determine how much money he should pay his due for the upgrade of his house. Isn't this enough?
Well, the public protector is such an independent body. We don't need another one to do it. We've had the public protector conduct an extensive investigation, which took more than a year, and she made a determination which found that the president must pay back a portion of the money and must take certain other remedial steps. There's no reason to reject her report. Her report is entirely competent and has legal standing. And the president's attempts to reject and usurp her report are completely invalid. And that is why we are proceeding with our court action.
Jordan Lewis is a South African member of parliament from the opposition Democratic Alliance. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from Cape Town. An official of Sierra Leone's Ministry of Health says the country will continue to be vigilant as it endeavors to contain and control the Ebola virus. Sidi Yaya Tounes, spokesman for Public Health Emergency Operations in the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health, says the Sierra Leone people should be reassured that no matter what, the country now has the means to control any new cases of the Ebola virus. Yesterday, Wednesday, Sierra Leone released 55 people from quarantine after declaring them Ebola-free. They had been quarantined last month after two new cases of the virus were confirmed. Tounes said those released had been declared Ebola-free by the World Health Organization.
These are people that were mainly close relatives to the index case. A good number of them also were involved with washing of the body and also taking part in the burial and funeral process of the index case. They have been in quarantine for the past 21 days and actually completed their incubation period, which is 2 to 21 days. And were released from quarantine yesterday based on the advice from the World Health Organization.
So it means that none of them was infected. But I hear you are looking for more people, 50 or so more people. Why are you looking for these people?
I'm not sure it is up to that amount that you just stated. But while we discharge quite a huge number of close relatives and people who were involved with the funeral of the index case, we also had quite a good number of relatives and people. She shared apartment when she visited Cambia District, whom she actually went to. So these people we're still searching for because we want to be sure we have eliminated every risk that is out there.
It doesn't mean here that Sierra Leone is ready to celebrate now. You're not going to celebrate, is that correct?
Well, no, I mean, this was not really about celebration. This was more about reassuring the people that, you know, no matter what the situation is, at least now we have what it takes to contain and control incidences of EVD in our country. And this was a classic example.
Can you give us some idea what it is when people are quarantined? Because some of the information I'm reading is that those that were released from the quarantine were jubilating. In fact, the entire town, is it like a prison or what? Because these people, it seemed to me, they were very happy to be free from there.
Well, it is not so much of a prison. But again, if you look at it, it is, you know, a very, very difficult situation, of course. You are keeping someone within a confined environment for about 21 days. And a good number of these people are adults. They were involved in farming. Some were involved in other businesses. So for 21 days, the farming activities, the business activities came to a halt. So it is a very, very difficult situation. And even though people are not in prison, but they are confined, they are being cared for, they are being fed, they are being provided with water and other household utensils just to make their lives comfortable. But no adult will want to stay home for 21 days without doing anything. It is a very, very difficult situation.
Sidi Yaya Tounes, a spokesman for Public Health Emergency Operations in the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Still to come, Mark Oldman's post in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Decision makers from Africa's power sector, investors and power developers from around the world gather in Washington this week for the second annual Power Africa Summit. It is aimed at alleviating the shortages of electricity that is plaguing many African countries. Mariama Diallo covered the summit and has this report.
The in-stream auger turbine is among the technological innovations exhibited at the summit. It uses flowing water to generate power, says Chunpeng Ang of Zuwedi Global.
So this unit, unlike other hydro energy projects, do not take years to perform. It is what we call baseload energy, unlike wind and solar that only delivers energy when Mother Nature cooperates. These units deliver energy 24/7 nonstop as long as the river flows.
His company just signed a 100 megawatts purchasing power agreement with Ghana's electricity company and hopes to deliver the turbine by mid-summer. Veronica Bolton-Smith from EnergyNet, the organizer of the summit, cites CARP ownership, dubbed the floating power plant, as another example of innovation.
They're able to pull power that's generated from their ship onto the mainland, and they've just done a project in Ghana.
She points out that some of the smaller projects are just as important as the bigger players.
We've got something called Shake Your Power, which is run by a lady called Sudha, and it's a little device. It's kind of like a musical instrument. You shake it and it emits a light. That's going to be really relevant to someone living in a provincial place who has no reading light or can't see their cooking utensils.
President Barack Obama unveiled the new Power Africa initiative in 2013.
We're going to start by investing $7 billion in U.S. government resources.
Fast forward to this week, in which Power Africa coordinator Andrew Hertzkowitz unveiled a free app called PATT that can track hundreds of energy projects in the continent.
What we've done with this roadmap is we've shown specifically how we're going to add 30,000 megawatts, how we're going to add 60 million connections.
CEO of Integrated Solar Technologies, Gabino Gerengomba, says more such partnerships are needed.
Electricity shortage in Africa is 90 million megawatt. So it cannot take only one company, it cannot take one government.
This summit goes a long way toward forging those partnerships and closing the electricity gap. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
The Zimbabwe Constitutional Court yesterday reaffirmed the banning of the country's criminal defamation law under which several Zimbabwean journalists have been arrested. Thomas Chiripasi of VOA Zimbabwe Service has details from Harare.
Chief Justice Godfrey Chigalsiku delivered the court's decision outlawing Section 96 of the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act, saying it was unconstitutional, adding that the Constitutional Court would give its reasons in a full judgment letter. The Constitutional Court ruling means that journalists who would have defamed people in their reporting won't be arrested, but affected people may approach the civil courts for recourse. The Media Institute of Southern Africa and the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists welcomed the court's decision, saying it was an important milestone in promoting freedom of expression in Zimbabwe. Veteran journalist Ngoni Chanakira said journalists can now do their work freely following the court's decision.
It's very good for us as journalists because we're being locked up sometimes on flimsy excuses. Now they will have to think before they take anyone in. And the fact that they've got to go through some process before actually arresting you, it gives us time to work and get on with our jobs.
His views were echoed by freelance journalist Watmo Makokova.
I think that section, that outlawing of that section is coming as a relief to us journalists because it's giving us the free space to really practice our profession without fear. But we only wish that this is going to be respected by the government.
Barnabas Tondlana, editor of the Observer newspaper, said while he welcomes the ruling, there are several laws that hinder the operations of journalists in Zimbabwe that still need to be challenged.
The unfortunate thing that we have is that there are many laws that work against journalists. So the fact that criminal defamation has been removed from the statutes does not mean that journalists are any safer. They are not, because we have the Defense Act, we have the Official Secrets Act, we have and many, many others, some of which I can't just relate offhand.
The application challenging the constitutionality of the criminal defamation law was filed by four journalists, Nava Machazi, Sidney Saizi, Godwin Mangunja, and Roger Stringer. The quartet argued that Section 96 of the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act also clashed with other sections of the Constitution that seek to protect the right to freedom of expression, media freedom, and access to information. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
The routine use of antibiotics to treat severe malnutrition has minimal impact on a child's recovery, according to a study published Thursday in the New England Journal of Medicine. The study conducted by the research branch of Doctors Without Borders randomly assigned more than 2,000 children in Niger with uncomplicated severe acute malnutrition, or SAM, to either receive antibiotics or placebo for 7 days as part of their treatment. Currently, the World Health Organization recommends a community-based model that includes broad use of antibiotics for treating SAM. Director of Research Rebecca Grice tells Ricky Shryak that this new study shows why the routine use of antibiotics for SAM should be reconsidered.
We looked to see if there was a difference in the likelihood of nutritional recovery between children that received the amoxicillin and those that received the placebo. In fact, we found that there wasn't a difference between the two. And so by looking at that, what we found was that it was time to rethink the recommendations for the use of broad-spectrum antibiotics for the management of SAM. And this is something that would allow for potentially more children to be placed under treatment, because it would mean a protocol that did not necessitate the same degree of follow-up, and also helps to ensure that we're using antibiotics rationally.
Was there concern when this was begun, this antibiotic treatment for severe acute malnutrition, was there the same antibiotic awareness that there was growing resistance to antibiotics?
Well, that's a global phenomenon. So that's not just linked to malnutrition or to linked to Niger or to the Sahel in general, but is the concern which affects all of us around the world in terms of growing antibiotic resistance. Because antibiotics, unlike other drugs, have been very slow to appear on the market, in the sense that once an antibiotic shows resistance, you need to use a different antibiotic, which is called a different line of an antibiotic. And there's only several of those lines of antibiotics which are available. And so without additional investment in the development, research and development in antibiotics, we could get to a point where people that really, really need this antibiotic, it's no longer effective because of resistance.
And as far as implementing a new method then to treating severe acute malnutrition, as I understand it, the WHO and the UN still recommend right now antibiotic treatment for these cases. What is MSF saying should happen? Are they recommending a broad restructuring of the recommendation?
We'd like to have the WHO consider this evidence in with respect to that recommendation. And so what does that mean? That means that in situations where there's an adequate medical infrastructure and resource to care, it's possible to treat children with uncomplicated SAM without including routine amoxicillin into the treatment protocol.
What constitutes a significant medical infrastructure? Because a lot of these places don't have that.
What we want to say is that it just depends. This takes contextualization, if you will, and recognition that all contexts are not the same and that all structures are not the same, and that in order to ensure that children are treated well and quickly, and also to ensure antibiotic stewardship, that this shouldn't necessarily be a one-size-fits-all recommendation.
That was Rebecca Grice, Director of Research at Epicenter. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Paris. While African Americans tend to vote for Democratic Party presidential candidates, their level of turnout in the 2016 could be an important factor in determining who is elected the next president of the United States, especially in a tight race. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports from New York.
The case is captured on video of deadly police force against unarmed African Americans over the past 2 years have galvanized a tech-savvy generation of activists to inject new life in an age-old push for racial, economic, and social equality. Carl Lipscomb, of an organization that advocates on behalf of African American and black immigrant communities, says candidates should do more than just make promises if they expect community members to come out in droves on election day.
It's not enough to say, you know, we want free education for everyone. We want to know how this is going to impact black people. We want elected officials to talk about how they're going to address the black jobs crisis.
The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says the unemployment rate among blacks in the United States, 9.4%, is nearly double the overall rate nationwide. It's a problem that extends to African immigrants. Bakri Tanja, a policy advocate at African Services Committee, says progress is necessary across all levels of government, including the city of New York, under Mayor Bill de Blasio.
He is a progressive mayor, but in his administration, I have not seen any African immigrant.
That was viewers Ramu Taylor reporting from New York, and it's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ulmer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with cricket. South Africa dismissed Scotland by 10 wickets as hosts Bangladesh beat Namibia by 8 wickets in Group A action at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Cox's Bazar on Monday. Elsewhere in Chittagong, the West Indies squeezed a narrow 2-run triumph against Zimbabwe in a Group C tie. Turning to athletics, former IWF marketing consultant Papa Masata Diak of Senegal, former Russian Athletics Federation head Valentin Balakhnichev, and former Russian coach Alexei Melnikov have filed an appeal against a life ban from athletics, the Court of Arbitration for Sports, CAS, revealed in Lausanne, Switzerland. The IWF Ethics Commission imposed a lifetime ban on the three on the 7th of January, claiming they had violated the IWF Code of Ethics. CAS is the world's highest body in the arbitration of disputes in sports. Their ruling is binding on all parties to the disputes. In Olympic news, some refugees at the Kakuma Refugee Center in northwest Kenya stand a chance of competing at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. The International Olympic Committee Deputy Director General Pere Miro disclosed in Eldoret, some 300 kilometers northwest of the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Miro says 16 athletes will be sponsored by the IOC to compete at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Last year, IOC President Thomas Bach disclosed that they will include some potential medal winners among refugees to compete at the Olympics under the flag of the IOC. Bach explains that this is part of the Olympic movement's solidarity with people forced to flee and escape life-threatening conflicts in their home countries. Over 100,000 refugees from Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Somalia, Sudan, and Uganda reside at the Kakuma Refugee Center, located some 900 kilometers northwest of Nairobi. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And we thank you, Mark. And that was Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 4th. On this day, 1913, civil rights pioneer Rosa Parks was born in Tuskegee, Alabama. In 1955, Parks was on her way home from work when she boarded a public bus and sat in one of the seats reserved for blacks. But when all the seats were filled, the bus driver ordered her to give up her seat to a white man. Rosa Parks refused, and because of that, she was arrested and jailed. Blacks in Montgomery, Alabama, decided not to ride public buses until they were treated equally. This became known as the Montgomery Bus Boycott and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement in the United States. On February 4, 2013, the U.S. Postal Service issued a Rosa Parks Forever stamp honoring the civil rights activist on what would have been her 100th birthday. Also on this day, 1986, the U.S. Postal Service issued a commemorative stamp in honor of Sojourner Truth, the first African-American woman to become famous for speaking out against slavery. And on this day in African history, 1968, the continuing persecution of Asians in Kenya forced many thousands to leave Kenya for Britain. Kenya had introduced new tough immigration laws which only allowed work permits to Kenyan citizens. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 4th. Congratulations to Edward Simon Peter of Nairobi, Kenya, Fred Egwan of Jinja, Uganda, and Abraham Lang of Jos, Plateau State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 3rd question. What award did African-American biologist Ernest Everest Jos receive in 1915? The answer, the Spingarn Award. Now here is our question for today, February 4th. Who was the first black student to attend the University of Alabama? Once again, who was the first black student to attend the University of Alabama? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. We know when we understand. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for joining us. I'm James Bate in Washington. Have a great day. So now we see the light. What you